Please stand by. Night school starts in just a few minutes. Night school starts at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. We'll be underway in just a few minutes. Listening to Night School. We'll be underway. The bell will ring in just a few minutes. Night School Season 6 kicks off in just a few minutes.
Ring the bell. It's time for Night School, the racing industry's national online fan education and player development program. Here's your host, Jeremy Plunk.
One of the most knowledgeable men on the New York racing scene is former jockey Richard Migliori. Mig, welcome to Night School.
No, thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for the kind words, too.
You've been around that oval a few thousand times at Belmont, at Saratoga, and also at Aqueduct. The nuances of the three different tracks, if you will. Let's start first at Belmont Park. That's where we are in the current with the Belmont Stakes on the horizon. What is it like, and what are the pitfalls of riding at Belmont?
Well, it's very easy to get lost at Belmont as a rider because, you know, just the sheer size of it and where the 3/8 pole, or I should say maybe the 3.5 furlong pole at Belmont is usually where the half mile pole is at most other racetracks. And when you get into the far turn, you still have about 5/8 of a mile to go. The turns are just so long. And a lot of riders get so caught up in, well, we into the second turn or the far turn and, you know, let me start moving forward. And you lean forward and you start letting your horse do a little more. And then you look up and you realize, wow, I've got a lot further to go than I realized. And I think we've seen it play into some Belmont Stakes upsets in particular because you get riders that don't ride there on a daily basis and they don't come in early enough and get as used to the surroundings as they should. And it's not like driving a car. Once you start a horse going forward, it's hard to take it back away from them and expect that they can get running again. So I think guys get a little bit lost moving a little early at Belmont, just again because they get lost with the size of it. And also, just there are certain horses that love Belmont because they're good one-turn horses, and they may be better at a mile or more, and we can run a one-turn mile and an eighth at Belmont. So you see horses that are very specific to Belmont Park, and I think that's something that people always need to look at. You know, that they, a horse that's been successful at Belmont tends to continue to have success at Belmont.
They call it Big Sandy. Is the composition of the track or the size of the track or both factors in that horse for course angle?
I think it's both things. I think, again, you get a horse that maybe doesn't want to go two turns, and his options at Aqueduct, especially in the inner track, are two turns going long or sprinting. And you get to Belmont, and the same horse that really didn't run well going a mile and a 16th at Aqueduct will really enjoy Belmont because they run, you know, all the way down the backstretch. They have such a wide, expansive racetrack that they can get in a good rhythm instead of having to run right to a turn and they're not handy and they have to do a lot of maneuvering. And even though the pace of some of those races is faster at Belmont, horses are able to do it because, again, there's not the stops and starts of a two-turn race where you need a handier kind of horse. And it is a different composition. I know some people don't believe in, you know, dirt is dirt, but that's very, very far from the truth. Belmont is a very specific, sandier surface, at times tends to be deeper. You don't see that Belmont balcony move you used to see years ago because they do a great job of maintaining the track and keeping it uniform, and you don't have the dead rail of years gone by. But I think it's a very specific type of surface that some horses handle better than others.
With those long one-turn races, the mile and an eighth, the mile and a 16th around one turn, do you tend to give sprinters stretching out more of an edge to utilize their natural early foot, or horses that maybe, you know, turning back in distance? Is there a stretch out or turn back factor at Belmont that you like to look at?
Yeah, I don't think sprinters stretching out do as well at Belmont because, you know, you think about how a two-turn race is run. You've got a horse with sprint speed. He'll jump off and run hard for the first 40 or 50 yards, and when he gets to the first turn, it kind of backs him up off the bridle, and then they'll race themselves. They'll prick their ears, and they'll kind of settle into a good rhythm. At Belmont, because they're on a straightaway, they'll continue to pick up speed, and they don't really get the same kind of breather that a two-turn race affords. So I don't like sprinters stretching out as much at Belmont. And I do like horses turning back because I think there's a certain stamina factor in the one-turn races that if you get a horse that's coming off mile and an eighth races, let's say at Aqueduct, and he's turning back to a mile, maybe even seven-eighths, although seven-eighths, sometimes they can get kind of outfooted. But certainly a mile, I think just having that little added foundation, a little added stamina really helps because you'll see the first quarter will tend to be moderate and the second quarter will be faster. And again, it's because they pick up speed on that straightaway going down the backstretch. So instead of having a race where they go two turns, 23 and change 48, they'll go 23 and change 46 and change, you know, on the one turn. So you do have to have a very fit horse at Belmont Park.
When it comes to lead changes, the horses run on a dominant leg inside or outside based on whether they're on the turn or on the straightaway. In a one-turn race, are the lead changes different than in a two-turn race?
No, it's pretty much the same thing. The one thing you will see that happens to horses at Belmont, though, is they'll jump back to their right lead early before they even get out of the turn because the turn is just so long. Most horses aren't used to running around a turn for as long as Belmont's turn is. Mm-hmm. Actually saw it this morning with Exaggerator working for the Belmont. He jumped to his right lead at the 5/16 pole instead of waiting until he got into the stretch inside the quarter pole. And again, I think it's just a little bit of a fatigue factor where horses aren't used to running on that lead for as long as they have to at Belmont. The other thing, too, though, is because the turn is so wide and sweeping, you can kind of get away with it where a horse will jump back to his right lead or be late changing to his left lead, and they won't really spread the turn as much, where at a mile track or even a mile and eighth track like the Aqueduct main track, they'll have a very hard time negotiating the turn if they're not correct with their leads in and out of the turns.
Now at Belmont, we've got two different turf courses to take into effect. You've got the widener turf course and then the inner turf. You've got two different courses. Do they play any differently?
Yeah, I think the inner turf is a big advantage to have tactical speed. Not that you have to be a part of the pace, but you want position. And a term that I like to use, you want to get your position going forward. You don't want to be taking back to try to tuck in to save ground. It just seems like you wind up giving yourself too much to do. You see a lot of races are very slow-paced races on the inner turf, especially the mile and a 16th. Because they're braking on the outside of the main turf, and they run up like over the little hump, almost slightly to the right, and then back hard to the left. And it's a very difficult race to get position the first 16th of a mile. And I don't think guys, particularly right now, and this is a generalization, they're not aggressive enough on that turf course. And you'll see the first quarter in 25, and once horses have established their position and you've already kind of put them in behind horses, now you're stuck with that position, because if you go to speed things up, now the horses that are in front of you are going to speed up too. Now you're going widest and fastest of everybody. You cannot win. So once you've already kind of taken back or allowed other horses to establish their position, now you've kind of got to sit in there and eat it and hope that you get lucky later. And I see a lot of riders get victimized by not being bold, not being aggressive, and not making a clear-cut decision early in a race. And if you don't make a decision, another rider is going to make the decision for you. I always said when I rode, if I made a mistake, I could live with it if it was a well-thought-out, aggressive mistake. When I would be down on myself was when I made a mistake by allowing myself to be victimized, not making a decision. And that's one thing now. You know, I used to watch races differently, you know, being a rider, being a competitor, that I watch races now and playing the races somewhat now. I don't bet a lot, but I do play the races, obviously more than I used to, that I get frustrated when I see a rider not make a decision. It's okay to make a mistake, but please make a decision.
That's the inner turf course, the outer, the Mellon turf course at Belmont. Or the Widener, I should say, the Mellon at Saratoga. The Widener turf course, right. The outer turf at Belmont Park. What are some of the quirks about that course?
Well, again, I think saving ground is super important in any turf racing, and in some respects even more so on the Widener course at Belmont, because, again, you're running around the turn for a longer period of time than most other turf courses. So, you know, some people think, well, it's gentler turns, more sweeping. You won't lose as much ground, but if you're wide going into a turn there, you're going to be wider for that much more time. And I think you give your horse a big disadvantage. But the beauty of the Widener course is you, if you're in behind horses, you could sit in there a really long time, because a lot of times you see the horse making the last run get up. And I think being more patient on the Widener, you know, flip side of what I think about the inner, is very important, especially if you're down on the inside and you may feel like, gosh, I got a chance to get out of here at the 3/8 pole. You're better off staying in there and waiting and then let it sift out later on, because, again, you're just wider for a longer period of time, and turf racing just does not lend itself well to wide trips.
You're listening to Richard Miglioria, the New York Racing Association. This is Night School's Handicapping Preview, How to Handicap the NYRA Circuit. And, Mig, let's go to Saratoga. That's always a good place to travel. But next up on our tour of the NYRA Circuit, riding at the Spa, I would imagine that it takes on a different feel just because of the importance. Is there more pressure on the riders up there, or is it a laid-back environment?
Oh, I think it's definitely more pressure. You know, the whole town is about racing. Everywhere you go, people are talking about it, whether it's at dinner at night or in the morning at the track or in town. The focus there is so much more intense. Most of the owners spend the majority of the meet up there. So, you know, I always said winning one in Saratoga was like winning two anywhere else, because you just get so much more notoriety out of it. And particularly if an owner is there and you win a race and they're in the winner's circle, you quickly become their favorite jockey. But the flip side of that is if you blow one or you get in a slump up there, man, it's really hard to pull out of that spiral, because it is a shorter meet, not as short as it used to be, obviously. But also, again, that impression will stay with the owner that much longer. And I think, you know, the betting public up there is just, everybody is so into it that – the scrutiny creates more pressure, and as much as you want to enjoy Saratoga, it was always part of the year that I worked the hardest. I worked harder in the mornings. Riding the races is more difficult there, because you got to walk through the crowd and, you know, be polite to people at the same time while continuing to do your business. And then a lot of nights, those same owners that are in town, you got to go have dinner with them or attend the party, and you know, not a great thing for a jockey, especially when you can't eat. So,
right.
Love Saratoga, but a very, very tough time of year for a rider.
How about the main track at Saratoga? Quirks, distances, things like that that people should know about?
Well, I think, again, a very positional racetrack. You know, I always felt like I wanted to get my position. I didn't want to leave horses too much to do there. Two-turn races, though, you can be more patient. very rare to see a horse go, you know, under 47 seconds to a half and stick around. You know, you think back to like Commentator winning the Whitney going 46 and change. You know, those are monster performances because you don't see that up there. You'll see a good horse go 47 and one or two and get leg weary in the stretch. Two turn races are very demanding at Saratoga, but particularly the sprints. I always wanted to get my position and hold my position and be very conscious of saving ground there as well. It seems like even though it's a mile and an eighth track, when you were able to cut the corner there, it saved you so much. So, I again, very positional racetrack.
Mother Nature can be tougher on the Saratoga turf course than at Belmont in the spring and fall. I mean, they run through the dead of summer. I mean, it's the hardest time. Anybody who waters a lawn knows that July and August is no time to get soft and green grass in many parts of the Northeast. At Saratoga, the condition of the grass course as the meet progresses, does it take any impact on the way you look at handicapping it?
Well, you know, it does, but, you know, as a rider, you were hoping you rode handy athletic horses, particularly when the course got beat up and used, because there'd be a lot of divots in it. There'd be places where the turf would peel back and horses would slide. So you didn't want like a bigger, heavier horse that was going to have difficulty getting over the ground and, again, sliding, losing his balance. You know, you wanted, basically, think about cars. You didn't want that big old, you know, Chrysler or that Oldsmobile. You wanted a sports car that could, you know, be handy and get you in and out of spots. So I think, you know, probably handicapping races to wager on it, you want to look at those horses that have shown the ability to be handy, be able to overcome trouble, because especially the inner turf there, the turns are so tight. And they run into the turns, the first turn especially, so with so much abandon up there, it seems that, you know, watching it now, it's hard to remember what it was like to be in the middle of it, because I cringe sometimes watching the first turn and guys, you know, how tight they get in and how much body contact there is. But yeah, definitely, especially as the course gets used up more, you want lighter framed horses and horses that are handy.
And finally, an underrated part of the NYRA circuit, it's not Belmont and it's not Saratoga, but the handle at Aqueduct, even during the dead of winter, is among the strongest signals in the country. So a lot of folks play Aqueduct, but it doesn't get the kind of scrutiny and national attention from racing media per se. So let's shed a little bit of light on handicapping Aqueduct. Let's look at it specifically in the winter time. When we get to the inner track and it's winter racing at Aqueduct, what are some of the key points that stand out?
Again, for me, is aggression. I want to wager on riders that are aggressive. I want guys that are going to go into the first turn, especially, you know, in the two turn races, wanting their position, not the guy who's going to be bailing out of a spot and allowing someone else to have that position. It's not as speed favoring as it was when I was, you know, back in my prime and where there were days like Keeneland was years ago. If you got the rail in the lead, you were going to have a big advantage. Mm-hmm. But saving ground is critical on the inner track. The stretch is longer than the main track. Actually, it's the longest stretch we have at any of the NYRA tracks is the inner track stretch. So it kind of gives you an idea how tight the turns are if the stretch is that long. And, I like to look at riders that do their homework. I think I won a lot of races on the inner track on the third and fourth best horses because you would look at a racing form and say, well, wow, there's a lot of speed in here. I've got speed and these other three horses have speed. And instead of, you know, just taking that at face value, then I would go watch race replays. And even though a horse may have all ones on his first call, he wouldn't have what I call true gate speed, where he needed a stride or two to really get his feet up underneath him. And then if I was on a horse that was very fast out of the gate, I knew that if I came out running that, hey, I'm taking no prisoners, I'm going to the lead, I could get the drop on those guys. And then once you've established that, a lot of times the guy will defer, and then he'll take a little hold of his horse. Now I'm in control of the race. So I think you see on the inner track in particular, the guys that do their homework and ride aggressively are going to win on horses that aren't the best more often than you know, not. And I like the inner track for that. And handicapping, I watch replays a lot too. So again, I can kind of decipher who I think is the real speed of the speed and who's not. And then, you got to handicap the mentality of the riders. You know, there's guys that have habits. You know, there's guys that don't want to go to the lead under any circumstances, and they're always looking to follow somebody. And then you've got guys that want the lead at any cost. So when you handicap a race, I think it's important to look at not just the horse's form and their habits, but the rider's habits as well.
You're listening to Richard Migliori. More than 4,400 career wins, most of those in the Big Apple on the NYRA circuit. He knows these tracks. He knows the riders. And you hinted a little bit about knowing the different jockeys and their tendencies and styles. Let's go through some of the riders on the NYRA circuit that fans see on a day-in and day-out basis. And tell me what you think they may do best or places where they may fit better. And let's start at the top with the veteran, John Velasquez.
Well, I think John Velasquez is the most complete rider we have in New York. He rides any kind of horse well. He is a rider that's very position conscious, puts horses in positions to win races. I think if, let's say I had a horse going to a $1 million race and I had to pick one rider, he'd be the rider I'd go to for sure. There's really no holes in Johnny's game from the way he finishes, the way he positions horses, and a guy who really does his homework.
What about Javier Castellano? He's been the Eclipse Award winner each of the past three seasons. Hasn't broken through in a Triple Crown race since Bernardini back in 06. But on the big stage, Castellano, as good as it gets, where are his specialties?
Well, again, another position rider, a guy who gets his position going forward, is aggressive. One thing that really impresses me about Javier, he rides any kind of horse. I mean, there could be 10 races in a day, and he'll ride all 10 races. I saw it over the winter a lot in Florida. He'll ride a 62.5 claimer and a $100,000 race with the same enthusiasm. And you can't say that about all riders. And let's be honest, you know, human nature, as you get older, you get beat up. You know, a $6,000 claimer might not mean as much to you because, you know, your body's been through the ringer and you don't have the energy level to give 120% on every horse. Now, that doesn't mean that's right. That, you know, the public deserves 120% on every horse because they're wagering on it. So that $6,000 claimer might be the most important race in the world to somebody who's betting on it or the owner, the trainer, the groom. But that's why I think you see a lot of times they'll tend to shy away from using the real marquee riders on those cheaper horses. They want a hungrier rider. Javier, you can't say that. This guy rides every horse with the same verve, and that's impressive. It's not an easy thing to do. As much as, you know, I felt like I tried hard on everything, I got to say, he impresses me. He shows up every race.
Now, you got the brothers Ortiz. They've kind of taken the year-round NYRA mantle by storm in the past couple years, Jose and Irad Ortiz Jr. Talk about the Ortiz brothers and what they do well.
Well, Jose Ortiz, to me, has just improved leaps and bounds over the last year. They're both extremely talented kids. They're going to continue to get better. But right at this moment, I think Jose, in some ways, is a more complete rider. He is aggressive when it warrants it. He's patient when it warrants it. He's won a lot of races by kind of taking control of a race. And you can't pigeonhole him into a style. You can't say, well, he's 100% going to do this. There's a certain amount of unpredictability in his game. And, you know, physically, they're both young guys that, you know, knock on wood, have been injury-free up to this point. So their bodies aren't, you know, being ravaged by injuries. So they're young and both very physically talented. Irad is less complete than his brother. Tends to want to grab everything and take back, and I think it's kind of been a thorn in his side a little bit this year. I think there's times when he should be more aggressive, and I think he's fallen into a habit from riding so many good horses that, well, if I take back, they're good enough, they'll come running, and I'll get there. And unfortunately, that isn't really how it works. One of the reasons Jerry Bailey was so good for so long, he would ride the best horses and ride them like they weren't the best horses. He would take edges with them. He would look to save ground. He would look to cut corners. And I just see Irad's kind of falling into a bit of a rut where he's times taking horses back too much.
He rides a lot of those closing turfers for Chad Brown, and part of that might be part of the habit developing, huh?
Well, exactly. You know, your best riders are chameleons. They'll, you know, kind of fit any situation, fit any horse. A horse should never have to fit a rider's style. Mm-hmm. The rider has to fit the horse's style. And if a horse is a natural closer, you don't want to change his style because that's going to take away from his strengths. But at the same time, you don't want to take anything that comes easy to a horse. A horse gets in a good rhythm and he puts himself in a good position. You don't want to take him out of that position because you decided, oh, I want to come from further back. You want to get in a horse's way as little as possible. And again, I think Irad Ortiz is a phenomenally talented rider, but I think he's kind of falling into a rut with that.
Give us a couple names on riders, guys who, when you see, or gals, when you see their name in the program, you assume they're probably going to send towards the front. You know, the jocks that are known for going to the engine in New York.
Well, we don't have as many, you know, as we used to. You know, it's interesting. Jackie Davis, you can count on her being aggressive. You know, unfortunately, she doesn't ride, you know, super amount of live horses. But you'll see her win on long shots because she will be aggressive and you know, put a horse on the lead and they'll get brave and keep going. I thought she did that very well several times this winter. You know, Junior Alvarado's a very strong finisher. I wouldn't say he's a guy that sends directly to the front, but I'm trying to go through a mental inventory of riders here. I'm sorry. I got a list here. Hold on 1 second. Yeah, Jose Lascano's patient, terrific rider. Kendrick Carmouche this year was very aggressive on the inner track. I thought he was a rider that excelled on the inner track, really put horses in the game and in position. Joe Rosario's a pretty much a chameleon. He can ride a speed horse, but he's also, I think his best go is when he gets a horse that wants to drop way out of it. And I don't know that there's a stronger finisher in the country than Joel Rosario. I mean, he really sets one down. Great hand ride. I'm seeing here. Angel Arroyo's aggressive. He was aggressive this winter, and I like that about him. Luis Saez can be pretty aggressive. Manny Franco, I think, you know, really kind of put himself in that upper echelon with the Ortiz brothers, like the young guns, guys that know how to get it done and athletic, real good ability. And I think Manny's been more aggressive lately. And, you know, Angel Cordero has his book, and Angel, known for his aggressive riding style, I'm sure has been tutoring him. And I'm going to tell you right now, a kid that I think's been riding great with limited opportunities is Dylan Davis. And I actually had the guys in our video truck putting together a split screen of Robbie Davis riding, you know, finishing on a horse in his prime, and Dylan Davis right now. And I defy anybody to tell the two of them apart. And as much as Robbie and I didn't get along well when we rode together, we were very competitive. I respected him as a rider, and Dylan Davis to me is his father. It's uncanny. And I think he's a really good rider that finally decided to stick it out in New York and stay in one place, and I think that's going to serve him well. He's going to have a tough time through the summer, but heading into Aqueduct Winter next year, I think he's a rider to keep an eye on.
Richard Migliore, you're a busy man with all of the NYRA simulcast signals and all the different programming that goes on. I know you guys have started a new initiative with the MSG channel. Tell the fans where they can catch more NYRA racing.
Yeah, we're on MSG Plus every racing day from 4 to 6 live. Andy Serling, Jason Blewett, Maggie Wolfendale, myself. And it's been going real good. I think we're on now 2 weeks, couple of kinks to work out the first week, but things have settled in. We've been getting a lot of positive feedback for the show. And, you know, one thing that Naira's doing now that's great, I mean, we have Maggie in the paddock. She's terrific looking at horses and giving people an idea of, you know, who's really standing out physically. You know, you got Andy handicapping and, you know, the work he puts in and how serious and focused he is about his handicap. And Jason handicaps, and he's a tremendous host. I mean, I don't know how he keeps track of everything. And now I've been given an on-track appraisal of how horses are warming up. And I don't think any other track provides that much information. And I think if you can combine the physical attributes of a horse with what you like on paper, that's a pretty formidable combination. Because a horse can only run as fast as they're capable of running. Horse can look the best he can possibly look and run the race of his life. He's not fast enough to win. He can't win. But if you're leaning on, well, I like this horse and I like that horse and I'm not sure, and then you hear a glowing appraisal of a horse in the paddock from Maggie and then the warm-up from me, or conversely, a negative opinion, something we don't like, we don't see, maybe it makes your decision a little easier if you can't use both of them. And I just think we're bringing like a lot of unique things to the public, and hopefully educating as well.
This episode of Night School will premiere on Tuesday of Belmont Stakes Week, Mig, so I would be remiss if I didn't ask you at least one Belmont question here for the 2016 Belmont Stakes. As these horses from the Preakness to the Belmont, or from the Derby to the Belmont, or even the new shooters to the Triple Crown come to Belmont Park for the first time, what are the challenges and what are the pitfalls for the horses going in the Belmont Stakes?
Well, I think, being a mile and a half, some people get the idea, well, you want a horse that comes from behind, and I think it's the complete opposite. You want a horse that is going to put himself in the game, not necessarily make the pace, but not give himself too much to do, because the Belmont's not usually won by a deep closer. The pace doesn't lend itself to that. You want a horse that's going to get a position and be able to grind, be able to stay, that's shown, the kind of stamina that it takes. I mean, it is called the test of a champion for a reason. So I think that's kind of when you're handicapping for the Belmont. You want to look at horses that can be somewhat tactical. Now, you get a horse like Exaggerator, who's going to be the favorite, and his last few races, he's come from pretty far back, but he has the ability to lay up close. He's shown that as a two-year-old. He showed a lot of speed. I think with a slower pace in the Belmont, he's going to put himself in position, and it's going to be his race to win or lose.
Richard Migliori from the New York Racing Association, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back on Night School, I'll be joined by Steve Bick as we hit segment two on our Handicapping the Naira Circuit.
Night School is brought to you by the American Quarter Horse Association, home of the fastest athletes. For more, visit AQHA.com. And by Keeneland Select, the official online wagering home of the historic Keeneland Racecourse. Sign up and get a $150 bonus and enjoy no-fee online wagering.
I've never experienced anything like it. I thought to myself, this could be today. Why not today? And it was. The horse went from last to first and won by a nose. Winning the NAC changed my life. It never would have happened without TwinSpires.com. I won a TwinSpires qualifying tournament and went on to take the $1 million prize. Play at TwinSpires.com and you could be the next one to hit it big.
Looking for some excitement? Get away to Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort. The gaming action sizzles, from slots to video poker to hot table game action. There's more winning excitement at Mountaineer. Stay in our newly renovated hotel rooms. Enjoy new menus in 6 restaurants. Heat up your nights with live entertainment. Play a round of golf. Enjoy the thrills of live thoroughbred racing, or relax in our spa. Get in on it all at Mountaineer. Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort. West Virginia Lottery, West Virginia Lottery Table Games.
Next on FAQ 60, the morning line. The morning line odds are not a prediction of each horse's probability of winning a race. Rather, they're a prediction of how the public will bet the race. Once betting begins, the morning line odds are replaced with the actual odds. There are two ways you can use morning line odds to your advantage. First, the morning line helps a horse player determine overlay or underlay values. If a horse's current odds are over the projected morning line odds, that's an overlay, and it can be a great value bet. Second, morning line odds are significant to players making multi-race bets like the Daily Double and Pick 4. Those early morning line projections often attract the most money in the multi-race pools, which decreases your potential payout. This FAQ 60 is presented by AQHA Racing and Horse Player Now. For more, go to AQHARacing.com.
Night School is proudly presented each week by Woodbine Entertainment, featuring Woodbine Racetrack and Mohawk Raceway. The 2016 Thoroughbred Racing season runs April through December. And by Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort, home of the Grade 2 West Virginia Derby, to be held this summer on August 6th.
Night School Season 6 back as we take a look at handicapping the NYRA circuit. Jeremy Plonk from Horse Player Now, joined by my Night School partner, Steve Bick of At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM. Steve, you're New York through and through. This circuit's got a ring deep in your handicapping soul.
Very much. Pretty much the core of my play. I would say that in recent years, California has really caught my interest, and more just by virtue of real comfort level. And New York, though, remains, I suppose, if I added up all the amount of cards that I publicly handicap and play, New York would win out. But I'm open to a good card anywhere.
Yeah, a good bet is never worth not taking. I know when you get a chance to plunge somewhere. Now, when you look at the New York circuit, there are three defined obvious areas: at Saratoga, at Belmont, and at Aqueduct during the winter. Where do you find yourself focusing the bulk of your attention if you took a look at the annual calendar?
Well, Saratoga, just by virtue of proximity and intimacy, and the 40 days, I handicap virtually every card, and for years have pretty much done every race of every card. The last couple of years has gotten a little tougher, and so maybe I'm down to 36 cards over the course of the meet, but on a daily basis, definitely Saratoga, Belmont in the fall always, Belmont in the spring. You have a tendency when you follow the NYRA circuit to just fold into the next meet as they roll along, because you do want to maintain continuity, and you also want to take advantage of things that you see, and whether it's biases or whether it's various bet backs or bet against, they're going to go from Saratoga to Belmont. They're going to go from Belmont to Aqueduct and so forth. So you do find yourself kind of rolling along the New York circuit virtually all year. And you do take a couple of detours, for instance, during the winter when the New York horses that go to Gulfstream, you follow them down, and that leads you into the Gulfstream season. So there's a little bit of that. And the same thing when the horses come back north from Gulfstream back and return to Aqueduct, let's say in March and April. But if you're a New York player, you lock in year round because it's to your benefit.
The difference between the meets in terms of things you're looking for, it's got to be a little bit different at each of the circuits. So let's just kind of go by them. We're in the heart of Belmont right now. This show premieres on Belmont Stakes Week. When you are handicapping Belmont Park itself, what are some of the aspects and some of the angles you're looking at Belmont?
Well, the fact that this racetrack is so unique, and so often you've got horses that have been two-turning at Aqueduct for the most part. Even at Aqueduct, you do get the transition from the inner track to the main track, and so you do get certain distances, notably a mile, that then goes back to being one turn. But the fact that so many main track races are one turn routes here, that's a big difference. And there's plenty of horses that benefit from that. And there's other horses that are going to be hurt by that configuration, and horses that now are going to have to run one turn mile and a 16th, let's say, the pace is going to be very different than what they were doing over the winter on the inner track, where they get the two-turn pace that may be their liking. The horses that train here at Belmont, too, I mean, this is a very different surface. And, horses that like Belmont like it a lot. And you get real distinct patterns in terms of performance and continuity. And some horses pretty much are going to jump up at Belmont, and other horses are going to absolutely fade away into obscurity, and you may have to wait until next winter to bet them on the Aqueduct Inner, for instance. So there's a lot of that. You also get the turf course nuances, horses that run well on the aqueduct turf very frequently will run well at Saratoga. There seems to be a real parallel to those two turf courses. Might be a little bit different at Belmont, for instance. And then, of course, because you don't get turf sprinting at Aqueduct, there's that nuance as well. So there's, you know, there's some real potential to particularly go back and look at the winner's book, for instance, a place like Daily Racing Form. They've got the previous year's calendar of results. Well, go back and look at what horses, particularly at prices, that jumped up, and watch for certain names that you know are still on the circuit that, you know, are going to be dirtied up, as Andy likes to say, that are going to return to form potentially when they get back to a Naira track that they've already proven they have an affinity for.
Well, you mentioned Andy. Andy Serling, of course, one of the racing analysts at NYRA, has been on Night School many times. You can check out Andy's archives at our Night School archives. Richard Migliori, part of that broadcast, was with us in the first segment for this Handicapping the NYRA Circuit preview. Talk a little bit about the TV production, because I know you're intimate with the media. You follow these kind of things. Fellow media members tend to really have a feel for what others can do and what they can't do sometimes. Talk about the NYRA broadcast team, because it's truly one of the best in the business.
Well, it absolutely is, and it provides a level of sophisticated comment that isn't really available anywhere else, whether it's, you know, Andy's wagering insight and his tremendous grasp on board watching. I mean, Andy has such an incredible, you know, statistical analyst understanding. He's a statistician by college education at Lehigh, economics and statistics. And he can spot anomalies like no one. And he is providing that insight to people as to what is happening that wouldn't necessarily, especially to a fairly neophyte type player. When Andy's looking at Will Pays and, you know, looking ahead at the probables, he's giving you a level of information that it takes fledgling players a long time to grasp. It certainly took me a long time to understand that, you know, watching Exacta Will Pays, for instance, and getting a read on, you know, on horses that aren't necessarily a price on the board, but they're a value to be had in the exotics, you know, things like that. It took me a long time to get a feel for what that information, how it could be translated, and then how to include horses in your wager that you hadn't considered. But because the board is covering them in pick threes or in doubles, for instance, it's telling you don't leave them out of your own trifecta play, for instance, if you hadn't spotted a horse from that regard. When Andy points out horses that are taking money, particularly maidens, you know, two-year-old races, horses that are taking money for no apparent reason, that's a great vein to tap into. You talk about what Rich Migliori has brought in recent years to the team, and you know, he and of course Maggie Wolfendale. You know, NYRA has always put a premium on a exercise rider's and a horsewoman's sense of a physical presence, whether it was Jan Rushton for many years, mm-hmm. having, you know, ridden in the mornings for Chip McGahey and her expertise, Maggie Wolfendale, you know, being the daughter of Howard Wolfendale, and, you know, basically growing up on the backstretch in Maryland, she has got really a outstanding eye for physical presence, for not just whether a horse is looking better or worse than in their previous outings, but also what the physical properties are saying about a horse's aptitude. A horse that is built low to the ground, a horse that's tall for the turf, a horse with proverbial turf feet, horses with deer feet for wet tracks, etc. All of those kinds of things, they're not always going to be right, and you can't always interpret that. You know, a horse that is dappled out and is touting itself physically is necessarily going to run well. But it's nice when you're a certain kind of player on a certain learning curve, and until you can recognize those things for yourself, it's invaluable to have people like Rich and Maggie to point out those properties. So from every standpoint, what Naira offers when you fold in things like Trips and Traps and the National Racing Report that they've done in recent years, it's a level of sophisticated presentation that doesn't talk down to the player, and it doesn't just reiterate past performances, which is of really no use to anybody.
I know in your daily show, Steve, you get much beyond just the stars of racing. A lot of times you'll have newsmakers on, but they're not the people you would necessarily expect to be making news. A trainer who's got a good horse out of the blue, a jockey who's coming off of, you know, a rising star kind of feel to them. Talk about some of the underrated people on the Naira circuit. We know about Velazquez and Castellano and the jockey colony. So who are some of the riders you think don't get enough credit?
Well, this is ever-changing, and one of the things that you get in watching the circuit is reads on guys that, you know, you may be betting on for years to come, or in some cases, there's guys that are going to, you know, just be there for a season, particularly when we talk about the winter at Aqueduct. You'll see guys come in. Think about a guy like Manny Esquivel, who, you know, who came in, he won some races, but, you know, now he's back in Chicago. Then there's people like Manny Franco, who burst on the scene and who have an instant success, let's say, as a Bug. And, you know, the Bug Boy has an advantage for a reason. And then typically the Bug Boy will lose the Bug and may have a learning curve period where they may struggle. You know, you see a guy like a Manny Franco, and you know the talent's there. There's also been things at work that you may not be aware of as a casual fan or somebody that isn't, you know, reading about the circuit and staying on top of all the news on a regular basis. And things happen, for instance, with the jock agents, and a guy, you know, may have certain period of success with a jock agent, and then, you know, may switch, and there may be a learning curve or a period of, you know, of off performance where, you know, the productivity seems to drop. But you watch a kid like Manny Franco and you realize there's tremendous talent there, and you stay on board. He, to me, is the most unheralded and underappreciated rider in New York. I mean, the Ortizes, I mean, frankly, Jose has now surpassed Arad. It's been very interesting to watch the two of them go back and forth. You know, there was the period where it seemed like Jose was the more talented, but then Arad seemed to latch on, probably by virtue of, you know, his association with Steve Rushing, Ramon Dominguez's former agent, that he then benefited, and he kind of rose to the top. He got involved with certain barns and with some top, outfits, and Jose struggled. Now Jose suddenly, over the last 6 months, he's kind of wrested control away from Arad, and Arad seems to, you know, some of his flaws as a rider seem to be kind of obvious lately, and Jose has been, I mean, brilliant. Luis Saez is a guy that I loved going back to his days in Florida, and basically discovered him, as it happens, in New York on the undercard of either the Gotham or the Wood. David Fox had him riding that nice little filly that Fox had. And I'm going to forget it might have been the Conley that they won. And I saw him make a move, Saez, and this is about 4 years ago, and I watched the race from the winner's circle at Aqueduct that winter with Foss, and the kid made a move down inside, and I turned to David. I said, he just won this race. And I said, this kid can really ride, and that was like an eye-opening experience, and sure enough, I mean, look at what Louis Saez has done subsequently over the last, 2 years especially. He is literally, among the top 10 jocks probably in the country right now. If you want to stay local in New York and talk about an under-the-radar type, how about Kendrick Carmouche? Kendrick Carmouche has come into New York and has firmly established himself. He's tremendous. Has been really eye-opening. Junior Alvarado, who some people had a mixed reaction to early on. Mm-hmm. I think people have really come to understand how good he is, and particularly at routes, particularly on the grass. Guys that didn't necessarily latch on immediately to the biggest outfits and get flashy horses to ride right away, but had to really prove themselves along the way. It's always gratifying when you recognize a performer in the irons, and you feel like you're slightly ahead of the curve. Whether it's a Bug Boy like a Franco or an Eric Cancel, and even a kid. For those of you that haven't been watching New York the last several weeks, this Jomar Torres. This is a guy that has got the seventh pound in the U.S., but he's ridden around the world a little bit and is way more sophisticated than a typical seven-pound Buck Boy. This kid can ride. So you got to be open and not just because a guy has got the allowance. You got to really watch them and look for them to do things on a horse that shows a level of understanding of race flow, and bet along and try to be ahead, because if you are, you get rewarded when it comes to the jocks.
And those apprentice riders in New York most often in the winter really have a chance when some of the name riders and the older, more established guys go for the warmer climbs in Florida. A lot of times you'll see those apprentices in New York really make their case towards a potential Eclipse Award. It used to be that Maryland was the proving ground of young riders, but it has seemed to be more, to me, Aqueduct in the winter has been as big of a proving ground as anywhere in recent years.
Oh, no doubt. And everybody, wants to come where the purse money is. And you completely understand that. And, be in tune with who is giving them rides, which more or less leads to a training outfit conversation. And, everybody knows Chad Brown and Todd Fletcher right now are going to lead the standings, virtually all year long. And even these days in the winter, it used to be that, some of the other big training outfits that would, dominate, and certainly Davey Jacobson with his claiming operation and the way, the way he is very aggressive placing his horses, those names aren't going to change a lot at the top. But if you're watching carefully, you'll see at certain times of the year, and virtually at all three venues, Saratoga, Aqueduct, and Belmont, trainers are creatures of habit. And, depending on their stock, they will pop with winners at certain times of the year. And I'll give you two examples, one that I'm very close to in Gary Siaka, and another that is easy to point out in David Dunn. Gary and David both have strong, typically very strong turf outfits. And so when you're watching them during the winter at Aqueduct, a lot of times they're running horses, if they've got turf horses that are going to spend the winter and are going to maybe start 2, 3, 4 times between December and March, they may be turf horses that are running on the inner track. Well, they're just basically staying in shape. Instead of sending them to the farm for 4 months and then trying to get them into shape, you keep them around. I've done that myself with Williams Lucky Gray. And then when the turf comes back around, those horses are ready for the grass, and they may have a jump on horses that are coming back from the farm. And, you know, look at what Gary and David Dock have done this spring. They're both having tremendous meets at Belmont, and Gary typically will pop with 3, 4, 5 winners just during the short aqueduct turf season at the end of the winter, because he's got these turf horses that have been staying in shape, and then when they come back to their preferred surface, boom, they start winning. Now, as it happens, I mean, Gary's got a number of really nice two-year-olds for this year, and then two-year-olds from last year that are you know, back as three-year-olds this year. The two that have won recently for Bill Parcells, for instance, Hit It Once More and Jet Black. And, you know, these were horses that flashed talent and took some time off during the winter. They've come back and won. You aren't going to get prices on Chad Brown and Todd Fletcher. You got to look elsewhere. And you look at guys like Donk and Siaka that have, you know, been winning in New York for 30 years. And they're going to get their winners. I mean, it depends on the stock. But, you know, people that, you know, that look elsewhere, you know, you're going to miss opportunities.
You're listening to Night School's How to Handicap the NYRA Circuit and Steve Bick of At the Races on Sirius XM, At the Races with Steve Bick, each weekday, Mondays 9 through noon. You can listen to Steve, and he's got not only the top movers and shakers on the NYRA Circuit coming onto his show, but folks from around the country as well. Steve, you're a native New Yorker, a guy who spent most of your life in the Big Apple. Now you reside in upstate New York. Talk a little bit about the mystique and the charm of Saratoga.
Well, Saratoga, from me, was always something special and unique, and looked forward, you know, to coming to Saratoga for years. I mean, even before I came back to the Northeast, when I spent time in the Midwest, you know, lived in Cincinnati and Kansas City, and then later Charlotte, I would still come, you know, back every summer and get at least a weekend in. Or two, and you know, then when I got to come back and live in New Jersey and in New York and in Stamford, Connecticut, I always, you know, would come up multiple weekends. And then 10 years living in Montreal before I moved to Saratoga area to Greenwich full time in '99, I would come down every weekend, and it always held a special charm. And frankly, it held a special charm even when I wasn't much of a horse player. When I was in college, I went to Colgate, and it was pretty charming to come to Saratoga to chase girls from Skidmore. And then only later, you know, did we start chasing prices at the racetrack. But it has a allure that is timeless, and it's, you know, the quality of the racing, the institutions on the calendar that just are always highlights of every meet, whether it's Travers, whether it's races like the Diana and the Alabama and the Whitney, or whether it's even new traditions and races that have been moved from Belmont at the, you know, midsummer, like the Coaching Club American Oaks or the Woodward. When the Woodward was moved up to Saratoga, I was so against it. I was aghast at the concept. You know, now I appreciate that it's a great season ender for the older horses. And it gave us one of the great moments in Saratoga history in Rachel Alexandra's win. One of the most outlandish things to ever happen at Saratoga in its history. A three-year-old filly beating elder males. Mm-hmm. It's just unheard of. And nobody can – people continue to research it, and they can't find it. That happening. So there are so many things that go on there unscripted, including last year with American Pharoah, you know, getting beat in the Travers. There's something happening at Saratoga that is special, guaranteed, and we don't know what it is leading up to every summer, but it is going to happen, and it's organic because of how special the place is and how historic. So it's just timeless and the kind of place that, you know, that people make a pilgrimage. In my years doing the barbecue at Saratoga, 20 years doing Carolina barbecue, I saw people the same weekend every single mm-hmm. summer. And that really, you know, that helped teach me a lot about what made it special.
Saratoga, just one third of that major NYRA circuit that we've previewed tonight. Of course, Belmont Stakes Week in high gear. Steve, I can't let you out without a question. When you're handicapping the Belmont Stakes, is it like any other race, or does the distance and the situation being the end of the Triple Crown season make it completely unique?
It's completely unique, and in fact, we've been discussing this week on the radio. In fact, you and I had a bit of this in our conversation today, and the mile and a half, and I'll reiterate what I've said the last several years as something for people to, you know, put in the back of their minds every year when we get to this Saturday in June. And that is the same amount of analysis and concern about pedigree and who, either by style or by heritage, is going to relish a mile and a half. It is no different than our conversation all winter long leading up to the Derby. I mean, we spend month after month worrying about who is built pedigree-wise and stylistically to appreciate the mile and a quarter, because virtually all the horses, except maybe the ones that participated in the UAE Derby, they're almost always trying the distance for the first time, stretching from a mile and an eighth. We even had a horse like Destin this year that was stretching from a mile and a 16th. So all that time spent, and we spend about maybe 3 days handicapping Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday when it comes to these horses doing a similar thing, adding a quarter of a mile. It's a significant additional amount of ground. And there's a huge difference in horses that are going from a mile and an eighth to a mile and a quarter to those that are going from a mile and an eighth to a mile and a half, or a mile and a quarter to a mile and a half. So why are we not as focused on that? And I always go back to a recent success as an example. Commissioner was a horse that was showing himself to be perfect for the Belmont Stakes well in advance. And, I mean, yes, he got beat by Union Rags, who got him in the last couple of jumps. But it doesn't make latching on to a horse like that was 30-1, it doesn't take away from the quality of the concept of understanding that a horse that is just going to go around at sub 25 second quarters, that those are horses that succeed here. I mean, people should learn from what the conversation was leading into American Pharoah's Triple Crown win, and typically the Triple Crown potential discussion every year when it was California Chrome, or I'll have another before he missed it, and then going back to all the others. The Triple Crown has invariably been won by a horse that was on the lead or near the lead, and very frequently horses that weren't even need-the-lead types were put on the lead for that reason to win a Triple Crown. And American Pharoah, the perfect blueprint for that. There's every bit of evidence that horses that grind away and grind away at one pace succeed in this race. And so horses that on paper have been too slow to win at a mile and an eighth or at the mile and a quarter in the Derby, and of course there's all kinds of reasons that horses lose the Derby, you have to clean your glasses and throw away the handicapping process that says, well, this horse is too slow, because they're all going to be slow at a certain right. juncture. They're all going to start to feel the burn at beyond the mile and an eighth. But a horse that it happens to be built by style or pedigree that is going to just chug along, they succeed here and keep going when others are basically stopping. And so the horse that is going 25 for those last two quarters, they're going to be a valuable commodity compared to the ones that are going 26 and 27. So you can't just preclude that horses that didn't look good all spring against the faster competition, that they're not automatic throwouts in this race. You have to suspend disbelief to a certain degree, and come at this with that same wide-eyed, fresh approach that you typically reserve for the Derby.
Suspend disbelief in a race where five winners since 1999 have paid $50 or more. It's the Belmont Stakes. Steve Beck, thanks for your insights on handicapping the NYRA circuit. We appreciate you joining us tonight.
Anytime, as always.
When we come back, Brian Natto from Capital OTB and Horse Player Now to talk about handicapping New York racing.
Night School is brought to you by TwinSpires.com, the official online wagering home of the Kentucky Derby and the popular TwinSpires players pools. And by BrizNet, the official past performance provider to Night School. Check out the exceptional and exclusive PPs endorsed by Night School at BrizNet.com.
Strategize, analyze, select. Join Keeneland Select to bet on racing from around the world on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, anytime, anywhere. Featuring the best rewards in racing, free pass performances, live video, race replays, and more. Plus, Keeneland Select invests a portion of its profits back into the sport. Join Keeneland Select today and earn a $150 sign-up bonus at KeenelandSelect.com. Dedicated to the sport and dedicated to the players.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BrizNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BrizNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BrizNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year, and is available at BrizNet.com/APR. The BrizNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrizNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrizNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Night School is brought to you by the American Quarter Horse Association. Follow the AQHA Horse Player Now official top 10 poll each week at AQHARacing.com. And by Keeneland Select. Earn $50 directly into your account with each $5,000 wagered. And take advantage of one of the industry's most generous players reward programs.
Our Night School NYRA preview continues with Brian Natto from Capital OTB in upstate New York. And, of course, our Horse Player Now Buzz Report has been our New York correspondent for several years now. Brian, welcome to Night School.
Hey, JP. Always good to talk to you and a pleasure to be on Night School again.
All right. We're talking about all things NYRA, and this is what you grew up playing. This is your backyard. You're from the upstate New York area. Give us a little sense of where New York rates in your mind compared to the rest of the country.
Well, you said it perfectly. This is in my backyard, and I think, I don't think I'm being biased when I say that New York racing is clearly hands down the best racing in the country year in and year out, certainly and especially Saratoga, but even Belmont spring and summer meet and championship meet in the fall ranks right up there. And I think now with the slot money that's infused some giant purses, the product even over the inner dirt at Aqueduct in the winter is really really, really strong, whereas before I think that's obviously when NYRA took a little downturn and maybe things went to Gulfstream Park in the winter or Santa Anita out west, certainly. But now NYRA is very competitive over the winter with the purses as well. And like I said, day in and day out, I just feel NYRA is where it's at.
you mentioned it's where the best are, and with that you get the best trainers. I mean, it's a who's who honor roll Hall of Fame. Let's talk about some of the different trainers in New York and some of the things you look for with their particular horses. The discussion has to start, really, at the top with Todd Pletcher, the all-time winningest trainer in the history of horse racing in terms of purse earnings, and he's still a young guy in terms of training, incomparables in terms of some of the great trainers of all time. He's going to put records completely out of reach when it's all said and done. From a handicapper standpoint, how do you approach Pletcher?
Yeah, he's tough because, you know, any race he's in, JP, the race kind of goes through him. And he really presents a quandary for handicappers because, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of a thing, because you're never going to get any fair value on Pletcher. But, you know, it's tough to toss him completely, too, when he basically wins, give or take, about 25% across the board with everything he does. So me personally, what I try to do with Pletcher is maybe use him to my advantage, maybe if I can single one of his horses that I like, or conversely take a good stand against horses of his that I don't like at short odds. And I think that's when you really get all the best of it with a guy like that, who you know the public is going to be on each and every time. So you can add a lot of value to sequences either by using him to your advantage on underlaid favorites that you would never play to win, but going against him as well on horses that you know budget players might be forced to single because they can't go that deep. And when horses like that lose, then things really blow up a little bit in the horizontal exotics.
Are there any specific examples where you feel he's a little more vulnerable, or situations where you're kind of licking your chops and saying, look, Pletcher loses 3 out of 4. As great as he is, he wins 1 out of 4. He loses 3 out of 4. Any commonality to where he may struggle?
Well, I don't have stats for this exactly, but I'm a firm believer that, especially up here in Saratoga, but, you know, even at Belmont too, when his first-time starters are not bet, they're not going to run that well, or they're not going to win. We saw it actually the other day at Belmont when he had a $700,000 two-year-old horse that was, Eric made him 6-5 on the morning line. I had him even lower on my line, and he opened at 4-1, I believe. Battalion Squad, I think, is the horse's name. Mm-hmm. He opened at 4-1, and Rick Violet had a firster that opened at 6-5, or maybe even money. And the Pletcher horse sure as heck broke slow and ran on late to be second. But, you know, it's those kind of scenarios where you need to be able to read the board and say, there, you know, a $700,000 Todd Pletcher two-year-old first-time starter in a 5, or it might have been a 6-horse field, that is a definition of dead on the board. So if you can read that, I think that's a great sign, especially up here in Saratoga. You know, you're not going to see too many times where Todd Pletcher pops on the main track with a horse that pays over about $10. It just doesn't happen. So, therefore, I think if he's not taking a lot of money, those are spots I like to play against him. And turf sprints is another area where I think Todd struggles a little bit. And frankly, a lot of the horses he's going to run in turf sprints are probably in there more like throwing something on the wall and see if it sticks, as opposed to spots that he wants to run those horses in all along. So those would be the two big spots where I would – lean against him if, the scenario warrants itself.
What about Kira McLaughlin, another trainer that's high percentage, has some of the best bred horses in the world for the Mock-Tomb family? How do you handle the Kira McLaughlin?
Yeah, Kieran's a lot like Todd because basically anything he does is 20-25%. The one thing I always pay attention to with Kieran, and the stat has leveled off a little bit in the past year, but for a while Kieran was pushing 40% first-time Lasix. He's not a barn that always uses Lasix, and he's willing to give his horses, especially the Godolphin and Shadwell horses, a few starts without Lasix. But when that L is, when you see that L circled in your form, look out. That can be a sign that Kieran's horses are going to show marked improvement. So that was a stat for quite a while where it was almost like printing money, to be honest. It was just, you just play it blind, and at the end of the week or month or whatever, you're going to have more than you started with, because that was a potent angle for Kieran. Kieran's gotten a lot better in recent years, winning with first-time starters. He was, if there was ever an angle once upon a time to play against him, that usually was it. But even now, as he's gotten more stock and some of the better stock of the Godolphin runners. His stats with first-time starters are up there as well. So it's tough. He's another guy, just like Pletcher, where it's tough to really go against him. You know, you play against him at your own peril. He's that kind of guy. But another guy, JP, where if his horses aren't bet, because this is a barn, let's be honest, that likes to bet and it likes to tout their horses. If they're not live on the board, that's a great time to zig away from Kieran, because typically they're going to run to the money.
You're listening to Night School's NYRA Preview, the New York Racing Association, all things handicapping, the racing in New York at Aqueduct, Belmont, and Saratoga. Brian Natto from Horse Player Now and Capital OTB in the Saratoga-Albany region joining us. Brian, as we continue our discussion of some of the key trainers on the NYRA circuit and your appreciation and attack mode of those trainers when you get to the windows, let's move to Chad Brown, because we talked Pletcher, we talked Kieran McLaughlin. Another guy, always bet on the tote board, it seems, is Chad Brown.
Yeah, JP, I probably send 3 texts a week to a really good friend of mine who's steeped in racing, and they're usually something to the effect of, this guy is just unbelievable, because everything Chad does now just works. It seems to work. He's getting European horses now that are just running freakishly off the layoff. He's now winning with dirt horses. He's got better clients, and he's really amazing, especially on the turf, but even across the board with what he's doing in New York, but even what he does when he ships out of state too, and certainly at Florida. But he won a stakes at, I think, 18-1 on Derby Day with a horse that came back and won Saturday at Belmont Park, and he's just loaded in the 3-year-old grass division, both male and female. And Chad Brown is I was going to say the next great thing, but he's already there now. I just think, you know, I'll tell you what, once Chad starts getting better dirt horses, and maybe once his training gets on even par, his dirt training with his turf training, I mean, just absolutely look out, because he's going to win everything. The problem is, and he's very in line with Todd and Kieran, is that if Chad's supposed to be 4-1, he's usually going to be about 5-2.
Right.
He might be 2-1, and he might be 8-5. So it really, really puts you in a tough spot as a handicapper, because you're never going to get fair value on Chad Brown. He's underlaid every single time. So what do you do as a handicapper? And I think Chad, even maybe more so than Kieran and even Todd, Chad is a guy you just have to kind of sink or swim with if you're playing the pick 4 of the pick 5, that kind of thing. And you just either have to say, you know what, this horse is good or he's not going to be good today, because you're never going to get fair value in intra-race. So you have to, you know, you're not going to be able to bet his horses to win very often. So I'm more apt to single Chad's horses in horizontal exotics, just knowing that that's about the only way I can get fair value on him. But he is a guy, more than anyone, that there's nothing I would put past him. If a horse hasn't run in a year and a half, I don't even really care, because he's so adept at getting them to fire. The one thing I will tell the night schoolers too, pay attention, especially his first-time starters, especially up here in Saratoga, but even on the whole, when he's got Bill Klarovich and Seth Klarman and Bill Lawrence, as his owners. That trio are pretty potent together when they team up with first-time starters. They like to win in New York. They certainly like to win at Saratoga. I would say those horses, the Klarovich and Lawrence horses, for Seth Klarman, that is, but the Klarovich horses are probably, that screw is probably turned a little bit tighter than their others. They seem to win in boatloads up here at Saratoga. It's a good combination to pay attention to.
The big troika of trainers up there in New York, as we've reviewed, Pletcher, McLaughlin, Brown. I think you really have to start your handicapping around those three guys in New York. And Brian, when you get all three of them in the same race, that's probably your one shot maybe to get a little bit of value, because the public's going to have to decide between those three heavyweights. And as good as their stables are, you do run into races where all three are active and live.
Oh, without a doubt, JP. It's just the nature of the beast up here, especially now that Chad is getting more dirt horses. He's going to be in spots with Kieran and Todd. And conversely, Todd and certainly Kieran have – plenty of turf horses that they're going to be popping up in spots where Chad's got plenty of horses. You know, we see it day in and day out in New York, for that matter. And then that is one of the few times you can get fair value on those trainers. And it just depends on where you like to, you know, land. And the for me, I would take Chad over Kieran and Todd in turf races, and then vice versa. I would look to Todd and Kieran on the dirt as opposed to Chad. But with that being said, as we all know, each and every one of them can strike in the other's backyard, kind of a thing. And you know, Todd's got good 3-year-old turf horses. Kieran certainly, you know, got that kind of stock as well. And Chad is now getting better dirt horses. I think he ran a couple in the Oaks this year. Obviously, he had a couple in the Derby that were, you know, were well thought of through My Man Sam, was well thought of, mm-hmm. and Shagaff certainly throughout the course of the Triple Crown season. So, you know, Chad is now kind of making inroads into their games on the dirt, and I think, you know, he needs to be taken seriously wherever he pops up, regardless of if it's turf or dirt.
Now, as a horse player, you're looking for value. I know that. I know you well. What trainers on the Naira circuit are under the radar, or guys you like to play their horses? When you look down at the form and you say, boy, I like the 7 horse in here, and you glance at the trainer name, what names do you go, wow, I like this horse even more now? What guys are the ones that kind of push your buttons when it comes to handicapping?
Well, there's 2, and I think the secret's out a little bit, so I might be a day late and a dollar short, but Linda Rice is just 30% across the board basically right now. Whatever she's doing, it just always seems to work. Her record off the claim is tremendous. She can get any kind of horse. The funny thing, JP, is, and I don't have the stat in front of me, I'm going to say something to the effect she's like 10% turf sprinting, where, you know, she won a trainer's title at Saratoga a few years ago because of that.
Right.
And she's like 30% at Belmont right now, and 27, maybe 6 or 7 on the year. And turf sprinting is really not her forte anymore. So Linda Rice is just, she is tremendous. Off the claim, especially. The other one, and Danny Gargan and Midwest Stables are printing money in New York right now. He is unbelievable off the claim. And you know, now you're starting to see underlaid prices on these horses, but he still is a guy that as soon as I see him in that race, whatever the horse looks like, you have to elevate said horse on paper, because Danny is just, he's unbelievable with what he's doing in New York right now. One under the radar, and he's struggling at Belmont, so you're going to get a little better price maybe, is John Toscano off the claim. Big, big stats. He's about 26% or so. He's really struggling at Belmont, but he is another guy that's really, really sharp off the claim, especially if he teams up with Drawing Away. In the last one, and this might, if you're well-versed in New York racing, this might shock the heck out of you, JP, but Gary Siaka is around 32% off the claim with a ginormous ROI. Mm-hmm. And I'm not telling you he's 3 for 11. It's like, it's a decent stat. It's pushing 40. So Gary Siaka is another guy to pay attention to, under the radar claiming trainer, who's been pushing a lot of the right buttons of late for a guy that was, you know, I'm going to say even a year or two ago, about a 5% trainer across the board. So that Gary Siaka and John Toscano would be 2 names I would toss out to the night schoolers that, you know, maybe you aren't familiar with, that aren't Linda Rice and Danny Gargan, that you might get better prices on, that do a really, really good job. And a limited job, too. And I think that's important, too, because it's not – that means to me they're much more selective in who they go after, as opposed to David Jacobson, who might claim 9 horses a week. Gary Siaka's, you know, might claim 1 horse a week, and I think that's very important, too.
In the wintertime at Naira, when the action turns to Aqueduct over the course of the winter, I know you've got a little fondness for the Rudy Rodriguez horses that stick around over the winter.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought him up, too, because he's a name I left out. And Rudy, especially when Rudy teams with Mike Dubb, those 2 guys are really, really sharp. Mike Dubb does a great job of identifying horses with potential. Slumber would be a good example. example that with Chad, but still has done a really good job. Has won Grade One races, and Rudy off the claim is another guy, and especially in New York over the winter, he's close to about 30%. And Rudy does a lot of different things really well, and I agree. In the winter, especially, Rudy is really, really sharp. That's a very hands-on barn that in knows how to read a condition book too, JP. And that's why Rudy's a guy that you need to have like in your stable mail, because a lot of times he'll claim a horse, he'll run him at parks if they've got conditions and things like that. He's down at he's got a string at Pimlico now too. So Rudy is very adept at reading the condition book, and he's a guy kind of, you know how that pool player is thinking four shots down the road. Rudy's a guy that knows what he wants when he's claiming a horse for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
There are spots in mind when he claims his horses, and whether he moves them up or down or whatever, they usually always improve off the claim. And the one thing I will mention, and this goes for a lot of these barns, even Linda Rice, Danny Gargan, what I will mention to the night schoolers is for these powerhouse claiming stables, I'm not too forgiving with them because they're so good, JP, that if they make a claim and a horse doesn't fire off the claim, I am very, very leery of that horse going forward, even if they drop steeply, because these outfits are all so, so good. Very, very regularly, even if they don't win, they're going to get improvement off the claim by their horses. And therefore, if they don't, I take a very, very leery eye towards them, and I'm much more apt to play against them at short odds the next time, even if the horse looks good, even if the horse is dropping a few levels, because that tells me that they might have missed here.
Brian Natto from Horse Player Now and the Capital OTB Network, covering all things NYRA here on our NYRA Handicapping Preview Show. And Brian, when you look at the three different meets at on the NYRA circuit, from Aqueduct to Belmont to Saratoga, of course Belmont's got two meets, spring and fall. Which one gets you most excited to play?
Well, obviously, JP, it's Saratoga. I mean, it's the best racing in the world. I can walk to the track. You know, it's an event to the night schoolers. If you haven't been to Saratoga, you've got to put it right at the top of your bucket list, because you know, JP, it's I forget exactly, I'm going to screw up the actual saying, but it's something to the effect of, get on the Northway, drive to exit 14, take a left, and go back 100 years. And then that's Saratoga, because everywhere you go have a drink after the races, you go get a bite to eat after the races, you just see people with racing forms talking about racing, and it's just so, it's so neat. It's a little more spread out now, you know, with the 40 days. So it's not like it was when it was 24, or even 36. It's much more drawn out now. But, you know, every single day at Saratoga is an event. You know, you still get 10,000 people on a Monday. You get 30 to 50 on a Saturday. It's, you know, I would assume it's just racing how it was back in the racing/boxing heyday, when people dressed up to go to the track. It was an event. It was a party. You staged your summer around it. And, oh, by the way, it's the best racing in the world, and everybody wants to win here. You see the most expensive horses, the best, classiest races, you know, upwards of 15 grade ones. And Saratoga really is where it's at, for sure, without a doubt. But with that being said, you know, even Belmont right now, and certainly Belmont's championship meet in the fall, as you draw in and it goes towards the Breeders' Cup, is top-notch as well, when every weekend is, you know, there's big stuff going on. So, Aqueduct, much more cookie-cutter. But I will say the Aqueduct main track meet now is, you know, a few weeks, 3 weeks or so, and it's really gotten good of late as well, because of the slot infusion. And, you know, I'm biased, but I don't really think I'm being biased right now when I say it is, you know, year in, year out, day in, day out, it's the best racing in the country. And that certainly starts right at the top with Saratoga.
Which of the three courses is more of a horse for course place? I mean, are you looking for horses that adore Aqueduct at Aqueduct, ones that, you know, played a big Sandy at Belmont, or the ones who year in and year out, the summers at Saratoga show their best? Is one of the three tracks more horse for course than others?
Well, I think, JP, you probably hear that more up here in Saratoga just because maybe there's a lot more publicity and a lot more people playing the races. But, you know, as far as that's concerned, to me, Saratoga is just, you know, your typical two-turn mile and an eighth dirt track kind of a thing. Folks, if you're night schoolers, if you're not familiar with Belmont's layout, you know, everything run on the main track at Belmont, with the exception of the Belmont Stakes, is one run at one turn. Now, the mile and a quarter races are run basically on the bend, but a 9-furlong race at Belmont is a one-turn 9-furlong race, which is basically a 5-furlong straight run on the backstretch. It's just a whole other cup of tea, and I think that, JP, I think horses that have main track form at Belmont Park are a little more horse-for-course type of animals, as opposed to, you know, horses that can run two turns at Aqueduct or Saratoga. The inner dirt would be another one. You know, I'd like to see some proven form over the inner dirt at Aqueduct, because that can be a kind of a funky, tricky racetrack. But to me, it really is Belmont, because these stretch out sprinters now are still going to be running flat out at a one turn mile, or 9 furlongs for that matter, or the two turn horses at Aqueduct over the winter might find that one turn mile a little sharp for them. So I think you do need to be proven and have some experience and shown you can run well over both of those racetracks, because I personally think it definitely puts it at a premium.
On the grass, Saratoga in the summer can be pretty speed friendly because of just the heat and the amount of wear and tear that the turf course gets up there. Are you of the taking that you want speed on the turf at the Spa?
Yeah, without a doubt. And you even want it right now at Belmont. If folks have been paying attention with how fast the races are at Belmont, it's just been a paved highway. But up here at Saratoga, and as you know, JP, as a handicapper, speed is going to kill, you know, any kind of spot. But on the turf, to me, it's that much more potent, especially when it's baked out. And, you know, we haven't had rain up here, which can be the case. You mentioned the heat, the temperature. And the other thing too, JP, is, you know, for the most part up here at Saratoga, you're going to be dealing with 9 to 12 horse fields on the turf, putting trips and traffic at a premium. And when you're in front or when you're up close, you don't have to worry about any of that. Kind of the old, you know, you don't have to be involved in the big one at Daytona or anything like that. And when they stack up off the far turn and
right,
you're eighth and you're looking for a seam, it doesn't always pop open. And, you know, a lot of times, as they always say, the best horse on turf doesn't always win. And when you're in front or darn close to it, that's a lot better spot to be in than when you have to go past the field 7 wide or hope the rail opens up. So I am much more comfortable looking for tactical speed or even speed on the turf, as opposed to horses that either need things to fall apart or horses that need a trip to get there.
When it comes to the wagering format in New York, the pick four pools, the pick six can get up and be interesting for sure in terms of the pick six, but not like it is in California. Are you more apt to play pick fours than pick sixes? And what types of wagers on the NYRA circuit interest you most?
I am pretty much, I don't want to say only, but definitely first and foremost the pick five, followed by the late pick four, which NYRA has really thought it was a great idea. They've guaranteed it now. 250 a day during the week, 500 on Saturday, 350 on Sunday. I don't know what they're going to do at Saratoga, but they're comfortably meeting those minimums. But the pick five with the low takeout, to me, is the best bet in all of racing, because whereas the pick four, you still need to beat a favorite in the pick four to get to make a score, you know. But in the pick five, basically all you need to do, JP, is hit it, and you're going to get paid, because obviously, you know, not to dumb it down, but it is one more race that you have to pick a winner in, so it makes it that much more tougher. But the pools are getting really big now, and the takeout is so low, I believe 15%, where it's, you know, it, for once in a sport where we pretty much, we, you know, we take a lot of the worst of it often, we're getting all the best of it there as the better in that scenario where it's a low takeout. The pools are huge, and again, you really don't have to beat any favorites. Just hit the thing, and you're in a good spot you're in a good spot for a score, and then, you know, God forbid you have a couple prices in there, a couple favorites go down, you can make a monumental score in the pick five. And at that 50-cent increment, that's really where I'm looking at. I will dabble in that late pick four. The early pick four kind of gets lost in the shuffle a little bit, maybe sabotaged even a little bit by the pick five. But now, this day and age, I am strictly those horizontal exotics. You know, if I have a buzz horse that I like that's, you know, in the 6-to-1 range or so, I'm certainly, you should never let those kind of horses go by without playing them to win in place. But for me, I know you like to, you are much more vertical and like the trifectas quite a bit. I tend to go the other way, and I'm much more horizontal in my wagering in this day and age because of the pools, because of the 50-cent increments too.
All right, we're going to get you out. We've got about a minute left with Brian Natto here from Saratoga Springs. You live stumbling distance from the best bars and restaurants in town. When people come to Saratoga, yeah, when people come to town, give them one place for a drink and one place for a meal.
One place for a drink, one place for a meal. Wow, that's a good question. The Seven Horse Pub, which is about 42 feet from me, if I stood up, I could see it right now, has a great menu, and the food is great. The Turkey Club is great. Then, and it's not expensive. That would be on the low end. Maybe Pinnell's if you want to spend a little more money. Forno at the end of Route 9. And if you want a drink, that's a good one. It depends. You know, if you're a craft beer kind of guy, Druthers on Broadway has got an awesome patio that makes their own beer. That's pretty cool. I'm a little partial to Harvey's with some friends that work there. And Harvey's is a cool, right on Filer Street, a good racing atmosphere as well. A lot of people watching, betting races, having a beer, talking racing. It's one of the places, even out of season, where if you want to come to Saratoga, and that's something that would be a lot of fun for people. You know, if you don't want to do it, do Saratoga in the winter or the summer. Harvey's is a place where you can talk racing a lot of times, and probably a good chance to see me there too. So.
All right, we asked for just one, and I knew you couldn't hold it to one on that one.
I've been exposed, I guess.
All right, Brian Natto from Horse Player Now and the Capital OTB Channel. Thanks so much for joining us on Night School. Plenty more to come when we return.
Night School is brought to you by Woodbine Entertainment, home of the prestigious Queen's Plate. Follow the countdown to the 157th Queen's Plate on July 3rd. And by Mountaineer Casino Racetrack and Resort, conducting live racing 5 nights per week, April through November. First post, Saturday through Wednesday, is 7 p.m. Eastern. Special consideration for Night School is provided by HorsePlayerNow.com Buzz Report, where 10% of every purchase goes directly to the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation to assist former racehorses.
$2 million National Handicapping Championship Tour today and plan your trip to Las Vegas. Visit nhctour.com for details.
And we want to thank our guests tonight on Night School, Brian Natto from Horse Player Now and the Capital OTB, Richard Migliori from NYRA, and Steve Bick from SiriusXM At the Races with Steve Bick. It's been great to talk all things NYRA racing. Best of luck to you at this week's Belmont Stakes, and we appreciate you listening in to Night School. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Plunk. Have a great week.